From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
Well, we started from the premise in this article that there's a lot of misinformation out there in terms of advocacy groups trying to undermine the scientific consensus on global climate change. And what we found is that, as it happens, a lot of the groups that are engaged in questioning this scientific view are receiving funding from a number of organizations, but one of the funders is ExxonMobil.
Big oil and global warming. A new investigation by Mother Jones Magazine reveals ExxonMobil spent at least $8 million funding a network of groups to challenge the existence of global warming. Then this week marks the 90th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide.
In the end, nearly 1.5 million Armenians were killed in the century's first genocide.
90 years later, Turkey has yet to acknowledge the genocide. Today, two epic denials, global warming and the Armenian Genocide. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from Los Angeles, California. A member of the Army's 101st Airborne Division was convicted yesterday of premeditated murder and attempted murder in a grenade and rifle attack that left two other soldiers dead and 14 wounded in Kuwait during the opening days of the invasion of Iraq. Sergeant Hassan Akbar now faces a possible death sentence, which the same 15-member military jury will consider at a hearing that begins on Monday. Now to the political turmoil in Ecuador. The country's new president, Alfredo Palacio, took possession of the presidential palace yesterday and officially swore in his new cabinet. As the official ceremony took place within the palace, crowds demonstrated outside in the streets and were confronted by security forces, chanting, "Out Congress!" They demanded that Palacio fire all members of Congress. Meanwhile, talks continue between Brazil and Ecuador over the fate of the ousted president, Lúcio Gutiérrez. Brazil granted him political asylum following his removal from office, but the Brazilian ambassador to Quito says he's been unable to secure safe passage for him to leave the Brazilian embassy for the airport. The new president has ordered Gutierrez's arrest. He's the third president of the Andean nation to be toppled amid popular unrest in 8 years. In news from Capitol Hill, the House passed the controversial Republican-authored energy bill. But the GOP first had to beat a flurry of amendments, including a last-minute attempt to eliminate liability protection for producers of MTBE, a gasoline additive blamed in groundwater pollution nationwide. The narrow 219-213 vote to retain that provision virtually guarantees a clash with the Senate, where opposition to legal immunity for the additive blocked the energy bill in 2003, sidelining one of the chief domestic initiatives of the Bush presidency. The Senate confirmed John Negroponte as the country's first director of national intelligence, giving him power over the nation's 15 spy agencies. The vote was 98-2. The only no votes came from two Democratic senators, Tom Harkin of Iowa and Ron Wyden of Oregon. The chair of the Democratic National Committee, Howard Dean, has come out in support of President Bush's current Iraq policy. In a speech earlier this week in Minnesota, Dean said, quote, "The president has created an enormous security problem for the United States where none existed before. But I hope the president is incredibly successful with his policy now that he's there." Dean said a U.S. pullout could endanger the United States in three ways: by leaving a Shiite theocracy worse than in Iran, by creating an independent Kurdistan in the north with destabilizing effects on neighboring Kurdish regions of Turkey, Iran, and Syria, and by making the so-called Sunni triangle a magnet for what Dean called Islamic terrorists similar to the former Taliban-ruled Afghanistan. Dean was portrayed as an anti-war candidate in the media during the 2004 presidential race. in what could be the beginning stages of a future U.S.-backed attempt at regime change. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice met with opposition groups from Belarus. The meeting took place on the sidelines of a NATO summit in neighboring Lithuania. Rice told the dissidents there will be, quote, a road to democracy in Belarus, which she has described as the last true dictatorship in Central Europe. Belarus and Russia accused Rice of interfering in the country's internal affairs. Belarus is an important defense partner to Russia and a vital part of its gas export pipeline network. The right-wing Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia got more than he bargained for when he accepted the New York University Annual Survey of American Law's invitation to engage students in a question-and-answer session. Randomly selected to attend the limited seating and close to the press event, NYU Law student Eric Bernot asked Scalia to explain his dissent in Lawrence versus Texas, the 2003 Supreme Court case that effectively struck down the nation's sodomy laws. Not satisfied with Scalia's answer, Burnett asked the justice, quote, do you sodomize your wife? Scalia demurred, and law school administrators moved quickly to turn off the student's microphone. In a post to fellow law school students after the event, Burnett defended his question, saying it was an entirely fair question to pose to a justice whose opinion, had it been in the majority, would have allowed the state to ask that same question to thousands of gay men and lesbians and to punish them if the answer is yes. Burnett wrote, quote, how am I to docilely engage a man who sarcastically rants about the, quote, beauty of homosexual relationships and believes that gay school teachers will try to convert children to a homosexual lifestyle? Burnett said he asked the question to, quote, subject a homophobic government official to the same indignity to which he would subject millions of gay Americans. Five Muslim Americans filed a suit this week against Homeland Security and U.S. Customs officials, claiming their constitutional rights were violated when they tried to return home from an Islamic conference in Toronto last December. The five plaintiffs are all residents of New York. They claim federal agents at the Buffalo border crossing singled them out with at least 30 other Muslims, then interrogated, fingerprinted, searched, photographed, and held them up for up to 6.5 hours after learning that they had attended the event. A lawyer for the activists removed from one of President Bush's town hall events in Colorado said Thursday that the Secret Service has opened a criminal probe into whether the man who escorted them from the hall was impersonating an agent. The man was dressed in a dark suit and wore an earpiece when he escorted the three from the March 21st event. The Secret Service has said it's determined the man was not one of its agents, but a staff member with the host committee. The White House has said the man was a volunteer who probably feared the three might have disrupted the Bush event. The man threatened the activists with arrest if they, quote, did anything and told them they had to leave because it was a private event. The three had tickets to the event, which they obtained from their Republican Congress member. Lawyers for Native American political prisoner Leonard Peltier are pressing a federal judge for immediate and unfettered access to 90,000 pages of documents they say were wrongly withheld during their client's 1977 trial. U.S. District Judge Donovan Frank said he would rule on the request by the end of next week. It was the latest in a series of legal challenges to Peltier's conviction in the killings of two FBI agents during a standoff on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in 1975. Peltier's attorneys believe the thousands of pages compiled by the FBI's Minneapolis field office could contain information about informants and evidence he could use to win his release or a new trial. Peltier has always maintained his innocence. New information has emerged about yesterday's helicopter crash in Iraq. It now appears an Iraqi resistance group shot down the Russian-made helicopter with missile fire north of the capital. A group identifying itself as the Islamic Army in Iraq said they also captured and shot to death the lone crew member who survived. And all 11 people were killed, including six U.S. bodyguards from the Blackwater mercenary firm who are on a State Department contract to guard U.S. diplomats. The chartered flight is being called the first civilian aircraft shot down in Iraq since the U.S.-led invasion began 2 years ago. An internet statement by the resistance group was accompanied by a video showing the repeated shooting of a man who was found in tall grass and forced to stand up and walk. The video showed burning wreckage just before the shooting. The man who was shot to death in the grassy field spoke English with an accent and was wearing a blue flight suit, indicating he was one of the three Bulgarian crew members. Two Fijian helicopter security guards were also on board the flight. The video also showed two charred bodies near the burning wreckage. The helicopter was shot out of the air as growing numbers of contractors, diplomats, and other civilian officials are turning to aircraft to avoid attacks on Iraq's roads. The downing is part of a surge of attacks that have caused heavy casualties in recent weeks. Meanwhile, a retired U.S. Army general just back from a fact-finding trip to Iraq has warned that the resistance may be planning spectacular large-scale attacks. General John Keane told The Hill newspaper this week, quote, "The insurgency is viable and resilient and has the capacity to achieve significant surprise." Keane spent about a week in Iraq late last month at the request of Lieutenant General John Vines, commander of Multinational Corps in Iraq. Keane retired as Army Vice Chief of Staff in 2003 after 37 years in the military. And on Capitol Hill, the Senate overwhelmingly approved $81 billion for wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in a spending bill that would push the total cost of combat and reconstruction past $300 billion. The Pentagon says it needs the money by the first week of May, so Senate and House negotiators are expected to act quickly to send the president a final bill. Lullaby for the Earth by the Russell Branca Quartet here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we broadcast from Los Angeles, California. Today is the 35th anniversary of Earth Day. To commemorate the occasion, we take a look at the debate over global warming. A new investigation by Mother Jones Magazine has revealed that ExxonMobil has spent at least $8 million funding a network of groups to challenge the existence of global warming. We're joined on the line from Washington, D.C. by Chris Mooney, the reporter who broke the story. His article, "Some Like It Hot," appears in the May-June issue of Mother Jones Magazine. We're also joined on the line by Myrony Bell of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. one of 40 organizations identified in the report that receives funding from ExxonMobil. According to the article, CEI has received $1,380,000 from Exxon. And on the line from Massachusetts, we have journalist and author Ross Gelbspan. He has an article in the latest issue of Mother Jones that explores why the U.S. media pays relatively little attention to the issue of global warming. We go first to Chris Mooney, author of Some Like It Hot. Can you talk about your investigation into who funds the groups that question global warming?
Sure, Amy. Thanks for having me. In this Mother Jones article, I essentially started out from the premise, which I knew because I'd worked on written on climate change before, that there were a lot of organizations out there that were challenging what is essentially a scientific consensus view that humans are causing global warming or are challenging other aspects of climate science. And what we did was essentially a correlational analysis where we looked at what the organizations were saying in terms of what they were saying about climate science. And sure enough, we found that a number of the organizations were actually receiving funding from ExxonMobil.
Can you talk about who these organizations are?
Well, by and large, they are, I would describe them as think tanks and public policy groups, largely on the sort of on the right with free market principles or sort of a more free market agenda. But you know, that's one thing, but they're actually arguing about, in a lot of cases, the scientific content of whether global warming is happening, how serious it's going to be, what are the impacts, et cetera.
Ross Gelbspan, can you talk about this debate around global warming?
I can, Amy, and again, thanks so much for giving this subject the airtime this morning. The very fact that you're using the word debate shows how pervasive this campaign of disinformation and deception has been. There really is no debate about global warming. What you have on the one side are more than 2,000 scientists from 100 countries reporting to the UN in what is the largest and most rigorously peer-reviewed scientific collaboration in history. What you have on the other side are basically a very small handful of so-called greenhouse skeptics, the majority of whom have been paid by the coal and oil industries. And for that reason, it has, because of their the megaphone they've been given by industry, they have created the impression in the minds of journalists that it is really a debate. And as a result, most stories until recently have portrayed it as a he said, she said kind of thing. And I think the public basically took the attitude after a while that, you know, come back and tell us what you know when you make up your mind. And as a result, the public has sort of turned off to this issue, even as the signals from the planet are becoming very shrill and the timetable for action is very slow and narrow.
Myra Niebel, you're with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. As Chris Mooney says, one of the organizations that receives a good deal of money, more than $1 million, from ExxonMobil. Can you respond to what these authors have said?
Well, you know, Chris Mooney, I don't really have much against his article, and I think he's shown that there are a number of groups that mostly, as he said, on the conservative side, that oppose the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty and oppose energy rationing policies. This is it's not a surprise that Exxon funds them, because I think Exxon is one of the very few corporations that posts all of its charitable contributions to nonprofit groups on its website. So I think anybody who's listening can go and look at those. Most corporations don't. It would probably be a good idea if they did. You know, this large megaphone that we have, I'm a little bit surprised that Ross Gelbspan has mentioned that, because, of course, the environmental movement, which largely spends a lot of its effort supporting the Kyoto Protocol and energy rationing policies, is a huge industry. The Sacramento Bee, a couple years ago, maybe it's 3 years ago now, estimated it was an $8.5 billion a year industry. Now, a lot of that's local groups, but if you just take the big groups, you see it's about a $3 billion a year industry, just the big groups here in Washington, D.C., which is, you know, a couple of orders of magnitude larger than the effort on the conservative side on these issues. So I don't think we're winning this debate because we have a bigger megaphone.
We're going to go to break, and then we're going to come back and have a discussion and debate on this issue. Our guest, Myron Ebell of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, author Russ Gelbspan, as well as Chris Mooney, both have pieces in this month's edition of Mother Jones Magazine on global warming. It's the 35th anniversary of Earth Day. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back with them in a minute.
If the Earth could fly away, could you see her flying straight through space and time, leaving all humankind behind? If she could fly away, if she could fly away, so far away. If the Earth could run away, could you see her gathering all the trees and plants, all the animals, all the birds and fowl, every creeping thing? They have never been her foe, never harmed her blessed soul. If she could run away, if she could run away, so far away, then she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for her blessed life. Oh, she'd be running for life. Oh, she'd be running for life, running for her blessed life. If the Earth could up and walk away, could you see her calling for all the oceans and the seas, all the rivers and the streams, all the whales and fish, every reptile that exists? They have never been her foe, never harmed her blessed.
Battered Earth by Sweet Honey in the Rock here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from Los Angeles, California. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about global warming on this 35th anniversary of Earth Day, April 22nd, 1970, the first time it was celebrated. We're joined on the telephone right now from Washington, D.C. by Chris Mooney. He's the author of a piece in Mother Jones Magazine called Some Like It Hot. 40 public policy groups have this in common, he writes. They seek to undermine the scientific consensus that humans are causing the Earth to overheat, and they all get money from ExxonMobil. Ross Gelbspan is also with us, has a piece in that issue of Mother Jones called Snowed. He is a well-known environmental writer. And joining us on the line also from Washington is Myron Ebell. He is with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And I wanted to ask Ross Gelbspan, if you can respond to Myron Ebell about this issue of global warming and whether it really is a problem.
Well, before I respond as to whether it's a problem, Amy, I'd like to respond to what Myron said about the amount of money spent on this disinformation campaign. I had figures a few years back in when there was a large organization called the Global Climate Coalition. It had 54 industry members. These were mostly representatives of the coal and oil and auto and heavy manufacturing sector. And a few years ago, the last year for which I had figures, the Global Climate Coalition spent millions and millions of dollars on lobbying and public relations to say climate isn't happening. One member group of this 54 group organization, the API, paid $1.8 million to a public relations firm on this issue. And by comparison, the five biggest environmental groups that also focus on climate change spent a total of $2 million, according to their own organization. So there's a huge mismatch in terms of the financial issues, that the financial outlays in terms of fighting this battle for reality, basically, and for the public perception. But to step back for a second, when you're asking me how serious it is, the head of this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Dr. Rajendra Pachauri, said recently that we have about a 10-year window to make very, very deep cuts in our carbon fuel use if, quote, humanity is to survive. This is a scientist. He speaks normally in very conservative and measured language. So to hear that kind of talk is very, very troubling. Just to give you one last quick example, scientists have documented already that the deep oceans are warming, the glaciers are melting, the ice caps are falling apart. We're seeing violent weather increase. We're seeing a change in the timing of the seasons. And all that has happened from 1 degree of warming. And by contrast, we're now looking to a century of 3 to 10 degrees of warming. So I think the urgency is very, very important.
Myron Nebel of Competitive Enterprise Institute, your response.
Well, you want me to respond to that. I hope we can get Chris back into this. But look, again, it's easy to talk about big bad industry and how powerful it is. Yes, industries do spend a lot of money on PR and lobbying, but if you're looking at the nonprofit world, which Chris Mooney's article does, we're really just small potatoes. And in fact, Bill McKibben recognizes that in his article, also in Mother Jones, when he calls us a small group of clever and committed people, and says what we've done to turn the global warming debate is one of the most mightiest political feats of our time. I think that may be a little exaggerated, but then what Ross Gelbspan says about global warming is very exaggerated. Dr. Pacharya, he's a conservative, button-down individual. Yeah, when he was in Denmark, he called Bjorn Lomborg worse than Hitler. So that's how careful he is in his speech. The global warming debate has turned from a scientific one where the IPCC publishes thousands of page reports, which by and large are extremely good, which several thousand scientists work on. They do not all agree with the conclusions in the summary for policymakers, which is, you know, 320-page summaries written by governments. These summaries then are abstracted by advocates for global warming alarmism to say, oh, we're going to have lots more big storms. We're going to have lots more of this. No, that isn't what the report says. The report, the third assessment report, I have it sitting here. It's a huge document published by Cambridge University Press. It's not an alarmist document, and you can go through and find some things that are alarming and a lot of reasons not to be alarmed.
Chris Mooney, would you like to respond?
Jump in on that. I don't think that that's actually a fair assessment of what the IPCC actually says. And I actually have a quote here from the National Academy of Sciences in 2001, and I'd just like to read it to you, because what the National Academy said in 2001 is that the IPCC's conclusion that most of the observed warming of the last 50 years is likely to have been due to the increase in greenhouse gas concentrations accurately reflects the current thinking of the scientific community on this issue. And I think that that's really what's at stake here. And the National Academy is essentially ratifying what the IPCC had included in its summary for policymakers, I might add.
Chris Mooney, you begin your piece by talking about the anti-environmentalist novel by Michael Crichton, State of Fear. Can you talk about the significance of this in popular culture and where you go from there?
Well, yeah, I mean, the scientific significance of it is probably not nearly as significant as the as the role that it's playing in terms of giving those who are questioning both the scientific basis for action on climate change and actually, you know, the economic basis as well, something to rally around. I think that Michael Crichton has become sort of a hero for what I would term the skeptic camp and also a lot of the think tanks that are sort of part of that camp, and that is because he's a prominent author. He has at least some scientific credential in medicine, not obviously in climate science, and he certainly has a megaphone. And so these groups have sort of rallied to him. Meanwhile, you know, the scientists who are working in this area have been none too pleased with some of the statements in the book. So.
Can you talk more about his book, State of Fear, and the impact that it has had? And what it is about for those who haven't read it.
Well, I mean, State of Fear, it's a novel, right? I mean, it's a novel laden with footnotes and charts and endnotes and author commentary that make it sort of a strange melange of fact and fiction. And in it, essentially, environmental groups conspire. Because global warming isn't happening in the context of this book, environmental groups conspire to make people think it's happening by causing big disasters. So, you know, I mean, a lot of people think that this is just sort of wrongheaded. And I think that I'd probably agree with that.
Mm-hmm. You also refer to Stephen Malloy, the columnist with FoxNews.com, who runs two groups out of his home that have received $90,000 from ExxonMobil. What are these groups?
Well, essentially, when we were going through the list of organizations that were supported, we found two, and we wanted to learn more about them. One of them was called the Advancement of Sound Science Center, and one of them was called the Free Enterprise Action Institute. And sure enough, we found that these were organizations that were linked to Stephen Malloy. And this is a commentator who essentially debunks a wide range of sort of environmental, public health, and other concerns under the auspices of his sort of junkscience.com website, but also in the media, including for FoxNews.com. And so, and it wasn't ever disclosed, at least as far as we could tell. We didn't see a case in which it was disclosed that actually in some of the places where he's debunking global warming concerns, he's actually been receiving funding from a company that obviously, would have an economic stake in climate change policies.
And you spend almost two pages with a chart, put a tiger in your think tank. Since you're very clear about naming names, if you could go through these, as well as what you call the Cold Earth Society, who the people are that you single out.
Oh, well, I didn't actually write that chart. I mean, that's a part of the whole presentation. But, I mean, I'm certainly happy to talk about some of the organizations. I mean, we have Meyer and Ebel on the line, so we can just, we can start with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is clearly one of the organizations that is most prominent, I think, in sort of arguing both against, climate change policies on an economic level, which I think, I just disagree with them maybe about that. But actually on the scientific level, then I think that it's actually gets into the area of being misleading when the scientific basis is being challenged and we have such a strong scientific consensus. So one of the things that Myron's group has done is challenging the U.S. National Assessment on Climate Change, and they've actually gone to court to challenge this document, which is a well-regarded scientific report produced during the Clinton administration, and it's actually been praised by the National Academy of Sciences. And again, I'll just, quote again from the same National Academy report that I was quoting before. When it talked about the national assessment, it said it provides a basis for summarizing the potential consequences of climate change, and then it went on to, base two pages of a National Academy of Sciences report on this national assessment report. So clearly the National Academy of Sciences doesn't see it as being a particularly problematic or troublesome document. So I'm talking specifically about attacks on the science of climate change, not the economics, which is something that people can argue about.
Myron Ebel of Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Well, I don't think that to go back to what Chris first said, I don't think that the statement he read from the National Academy of Sciences is alarming, and in fact, I don't see much reason to disagree with it. The fact is, there's a sort of a tissue of you start with the premise that the climate is changing, and pretty soon you're talking about how scary it is. Well, the climate's changing all the time. The impacts are significant. If you look at the United States, for example, there is no warming or cooling trend if you average out the entire country. And that's true for quite a long time going back into the past. However, there are significant climate changes going on. The Pacific Northwest is warming up. The Atlantic Southeast, Florida, Georgia, Alabama, the Carolinas are cooling down. These are long-term trends, 30, 40 years. They're very significant. They have costs. They have environmental impacts, and we have to deal with them. You can't predict on the basis of knowing what the global mean temperature is and whether it's going up or going down that the Pacific Northwest is warming up and the Atlantic Southeast is cooling down. There's no way to get that. So, again, I think it's a lot of the alarmism is based on absolutely unalarming statements, which have been sort of whipped up into a frenzy by people who really ought to know better.
Finally, Ross Gelbspan, giving you the last word.
Real briefly, what Myron is saying about temperatures is really very, very misleading. 1998 was the hottest year on record, and the 2001 replaced 97 as number two. 2004 was the fourth hottest year on record. So globally what's happening is that the planet is warming. And what we're seeing also is a much more unstable kind of climate with many more storms and more changes and more surprises. We're seeing shorter but more severe winters, which will begin to take a much bigger toll on agriculture. There's no question about the larger trends of what's happening to the climate, regardless of how you cut it. And as the head of the IPCC said a couple of years ago, there is no debate among any statured scientist at all about the larger trends of what's happening to the climate. So I think that's very disingenuous. And I think it's very important to understand, again, that we have a really short time for action. And I'll go back to one study that was put out by a major group of scientists and policymakers at the beginning of the year, which said that we now have 380 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Traditionally, that number was 280. When it reaches 400 parts per million, which will be within the next 10, 15 years, that correlates with an increase of 2 degrees Celsius in the average global temperature, and that is the point at which a lot of impacts begin to sort of take on their own momentum and become runaway impacts. So scientists are really concerned about changes in the Gulf Stream, rapid temperature changes, die-offs of the forest, all kinds of things like this, which will begin to happen in a very, very short time if we keep pumping out all these carbon fuels. And this is not alarmism. This is from the scientific community, and there is really no debate about what is happening to the climate among the mainstream body of climate scientists.
Russ Gelbspen, we'll have to leave it there. I want to thank you for being with us as well. I want to thank Myra Nobel of the Competitive Enterprise Institute and Chris Mooney. Both Chris Mooney and Russ Gelbspen have pieces in this month's issue of Mother Jones, the title of the issue, As the World Burns. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from Los Angeles. And here in California, well, let me read from the Daily Bruin, which is the UCLA college paper. It says, for almost 3 weeks, students, young professionals, and even a grandmother put their lives on hold to remember the lives of others. These Armenian Americans walked 215 miles from Fresno to Sacramento to honor those killed and displaced by Ottoman Turkey between 1915 and 1923 during the Armenian Genocide. The participants in March for Humanity ended their journey Thursday morning at the state capitol after walking about 15 miles each day since April 2nd. They were greeted by California legislators, invited onto the floors of the House and the Senate here, both of which unanimously approved legislation establishing April 24th as the California Day of Remembrance of the Armenian Genocide. Yes, this week marks the 90th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. On April 24th, 1915, the Young Turk government of the Ottoman Empire began a systematic, premeditated genocide of the Armenian people, an unarmed Christian minority living under Turkish rule. More than 1 million Armenians were exterminated through direct killing, starvation, torture, and forced death marches. Another 1 million fled into permanent exile. An ancient civilization was expunged from its homeland of 2,500 years. Today, almost a century later, the Turkish government continues to deny the genocide. Books about the genocide are banned in Turkey. Its government funds chairs in Turkish studies at American universities to ensure a certain version of history is presented. To this day, Turkey and Armenia don't have diplomatic relations. But now, Ankara's ambitions to join the European Union are in jeopardy. French President Jacques Chirac has said Ankara must first acknowledge the genocide before being allowed to become a member of the EU. In response, the Turkish prime minister has called for a, quote, impartial study by historians concerning the fate of the Armenian people during World War I. today we look at the Armenian genocide. We're joined in our New York studio by Peter Balakian, professor of English at Colgate University and author of The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide and America's Response. Here in our Los Angeles studio, we're joined by Zanku Armenian of the Armenian National Committee of America. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Peter Balakian, let's begin with you. If you can simply start off by telling us what happened 90 years ago.
Well, I think it's important for people to understand that the plan to exterminate the Armenians of what is today Turkey, then Ottoman Turkey, was implemented by the central government, and it was a very well-organized plan. It involved the formation of mobile killing squads. It involved a central bureaucracy called the Special Organization. The Special Organization put into gear the mobile killing squads, and the killing squads were made up of some 30,000 convicts who had been released from prison, a little bit like the Nazis' Einsatzgruppen. It's also important to understand that there was emergency executive legislation used to implement this plan, that technology was used to train to deport Armenians from the western part of Turkey down to the south and into the desert. And it's important to understand that the population was systematically dismembered. And the reason Armenians commemorate the genocide on April 24 is because on that evening in Constantinople, more than 250 Armenian intellectuals and community leaders were arrested and deported by train to the interior, where they were subsequently tortured and murdered. And the idea here is, of course, that you cut the head off the culture, you rip its tongue out. It's journalists, it's poets, it's playwrights, it's novelists, it's clergy and professors. So this was very systematically done, and it's important to understand that this whole operation, which in the end resulted in the deaths of close to 1.5 million unarmed, innocent, minority population citizens of Turkey, this became the template for all genocide to follow. And Adolf Hitler did say 8 days before invading Poland in 1939, who today, after all, speaks of the annihilation of the Armenians. Hitler was inspired by the fact that the Young Turk government had succeeded in doing what they did, and also he was inspired by the fact that what had been the most important international human rights catastrophe of the second decade of the 20th century had only 20 years later been sort of washed down the memory hole.
Peter Balakian, we're going to break and then come back to this discussion on this 90th anniversary of the Armenian genocide. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Zim chuzim shtam lo vortin zoma zoma er zim lachak tam lo vortin koma koma er voch ara voch havnetsa zoma zoma er voch hanizam galzoven koma koma er zoma er zoma er zoma er zoma zoma er zoma er zoma er zoma zoma er zoma er zoma er zoma zoma Zim chuzin shtam lo vortin zoma zoma er zim kulbatam lo vortin koma koma er voch ara voch havnetsa zoma zoma er voch hanidzam galzoven koma koma er zoma er zoma er zoma er zoma 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 zim chuzin shtam lo vortin zoma zoma er zim shavik tam lo vortin koma koma er voch ara
Zulal, Armenian group here. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Los Angeles, California, on this 90th anniversary of the Armenian genocide. This morning, about 4 o'clock, as we were driving to the studio, we made a right turn on Little Armenia Yes, this area has the highest concentration of Armenian Americans anywhere in the country. Our guests are Peter Balakian. He's in the New York studio, author of The Burning Tigris, also professor of English at Colgate University. And here in our Los Angeles studio, we're joined by Zanku Armenian of the Armenian National Committee of America. And we welcome you as well to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Can you describe this area, this highly concentrated area of Armenian Americans?
Yeah, we basically have about 400,000, half a million Armenians just in the Southland area in Los Angeles, in various smaller cities around this area. And this community has grown relatively newly compared to the East Coast in that it a lot of immigration happened from different wars that are unrest that has happened in the Middle East upheaval in the Soviet Union, et cetera, we've had a lot of immigration that's happened here. So this population tends to be more newly immigrated in that they've immigrated in the last 20 years, a lot of first-generation Armenian-Americans.
And can you talk about the significance of this march that was taken by students and others from Fresno to Sacramento and the naming of this weekend of April 24th as the California Day of Remembrance of the Armenian Genocide?
Yes. Well, the March for Humanity was actually organized by the Armenian Youth Federation, which is a very large youth organization for the Armenian American community here in the U.S. And they decided that they wanted to do something that was symbolic of not only the marches that their grandparents and great-grandparents went through as part of the forced marches in Turkey, but also wanted to do something in the name of greater humanity as we see other genocides happening, to bring attention to the issue of genocide in general. So it was decided that this march would take place 215 miles, starting from Fresno, which is actually the oldest Armenian community in California. This group would start their march, and it would end in Sacramento. And in Sacramento, yesterday we had a rally in the state capitol where about approximately 1,500 Armenian Americans gathered with legislators from both the state assembly as well as the Senate to mark this day, as well as have legislation passed which permanently designates the week of April 24th as a week of remembrance for California from this point forward.
Hmm. Peter Balakian, who denies that the genocide took place? What are the various forces and their influence here in this country, for example?
Well, I think that the denial is propelled mostly by Ankara, by the Turkish government, and it has impact mostly in State Departments, on State Department levels. The good news is that really the grassroots intellectual world and the educational world and the curricular world in the United States, for example, have really put forth a very impressive scholarly discourse on the Armenian Genocide that has grown year by year. The Armenian Genocide is now being taught in the curriculum as a staple of the 20th century history and, for example, the history of World War I. But the Turkish government's denial persists, and scholars of genocide around the world continue to articulate this, that the denial of genocide is the final stage of genocide because it seeks to demonize the victims and rehabilitate the perpetrators, and because it sends the message that genocide demands no moral accountability, no moral response. So the Turkish government's denial is a serious ethical issue. It's become an international ethical issue. Turkey has a few hired hands, I would call them, scholars who have given their careers to help defend the Turkish state in its efforts to cover up and sanitize its past. But I think for the most part, this has been unmasked for what it is by the general scholarly community. I would note, you mentioned earlier that the Turkish prime minister has called for an impartial investigation into the Armenian Genocide. And it's important to note that the International Association of Genocide Scholars has responded in a formal letter to the Turkish prime minister by reminding the prime minister that the record on the Armenian Genocide is in. It is abundantly documented by 8 decades of scholarship and by the unanimous consent consensus of genocide scholars worldwide, and that the man who coined and invented the term genocide, Raphael Lemkin, the Polish-Jewish jurist and legal scholar, did so in large part on the basis of what had happened to the Armenians in 1915 and on the basis of what had happened to the Jews during the Holocaust. So really, the Armenian extermination is part of the etymology of the word genocide. And the International Association of Genocide Scholars is making a statement to Turkey to acknowledge the historical record and to make it clear that calling for an impartial investigation is nothing more than a public relations gimmick. And sooner or later, I think the Turkish government has no choice but to own up to the truth.
What would it lose almost a century later? Why would the current Turkish government, for example, lose any standing?
Well, I think actually quite the contrary, that the Turkish government would gain an enormous amount of respect in the eyes of the world if it were able to come to terms morally with the crimes of its culture's past, the way Germany has done with the Holocaust, for example. It bewilders intellectuals and scholars and others worldwide as to why Turkey continues to maintain this irrational and one, I think, must call it a hysterical response to the Armenian genocide past. And I think Turkey, if it wants to show that it has the dimensions of democratic culture in its own society, that it must begin to learn how to critique its past honestly, and I think this will help it in its bid to join at least the accession process. I realize that admission to Europe is a long way off for Turkey, but even just to get the accession process going, I think that coming clean on this would help Turkey immensely.
Let me ask Zanku Armenian if you've had family members killed in the genocide, and what happened to them exactly?
Well, my great-grandparents and grandparents were from the central Anatolia area. Luckily, my immediate grandparents did survive. They were marched at a young age and were able to escape towards the south, one through the Cilicia region, which is the region of Turkey that actually borders the Mediterranean Sea, and others through Syria, and they were able to escape. But several hundred members of my extended family were part of the victims, 1.5 million victims of the Armenian genocide. But, you know, growing up here in the U.S., you know, as you interact with your grandparents, and this is a very common experience for Armenian Americans, you hear the stories, you know, you hear the stories of escape, the stories of heroism at a very, very young age, something that we would not even fathom in this country, even thinking about, because, you know, I'm talking about 5 years old, 7 years old, 8 years old, being rescued or just escaping through other families while they've left their main families behind.
Peter Balakian, what does the Turkish government say happened?
I think the Turkish government basically wants to confuse and divert attention from the truth. So they will say anything, really. But I think the main things you will hear are, A, this was not planned or organized. It's something that happened during World War One. It got out of control. We don't really know what happened to the more than 2 million Armenians living on their historic homeland. And that is why I underscored in the beginning of our conversation how meticulously this event was planned. Secondly, the Turkish government wants the world to believe that somehow the Armenians were seditious, that they were trying to take down the Ottoman Empire, and that they and the Turkish government will use the term civil war, which is really an obscene notion, because an unarmed Christian minority population living in the Ottoman Empire was not capable of engaging in anything close to civil war. These were defenseless civilians, more than half of them women and children and elderly people who were massacred and deported, raped and tortured. These were professors and writers sitting in their in their classrooms and at their desks who were ripped from their homes in the middle of the night. The idea that this could be civil war is absolutely a fantasy. And of course, we understand that genocide is always the result of an asymmetry in power, that there's a defenseless, stateless people who are being annihilated systematically by a government that has a military apparatus and a huge state bureaucracy. And that, of course, is one of the defining dimensions of modern genocide.
And Amy, if I could add something to what Peter is saying and something that you asked about previously, which is why Turkey spends so much effort in denying this genocide. Let's not forget that there are actually two parts of the equation. There's the issue of coming to terms with their past. That's the first part. The second part that comes right after that is what are the consequences to that crime? Because if there are no consequences to the crime, then it can be repeated again in the future. Just like Germany to this day pays reparations to the State of Israel and the Jewish people, that is part of the main issue that is behind in the back of their minds as well. And so that is one side of the equation. And I would say here in the U.S., the U.S. government has complicity in this issue in that it supports Turkey in this denialist campaign. Instead of breaking from Turkey and showing the leadership, showing Turkey how a democracy acts, saying, Turkey, you are our ally. However, we are not going to help you cover up this crime. You must come to terms with these past. So we expect the U.S. government to break from Turkey on this issue. But unfortunately, the State Department uses this issue as a way to leverage Turkey in diplomatic circles.
What do you mean?
Well, they will use this issue. They will dangle it out there saying, you know, there's this Armenian genocide issue, Turkey. You know, things can pass in the U.S. Congress. Commemorative resolutions could pass. They start to rattle their cage a little bit and use that as a way to say, you know, if you don't behave in the area, if you don't follow our policy objectives, then we're going to let the Armenian genocide out of its box.
So you're calling for reparations?
I'm calling for that there have to be consequences with any crime. Hmm. Otherwise, for them to just accept the genocide is meaningless. We already know that there was a genocide.
Peter Balakian, we had a discussion on Democracy Now! A while ago about Microsoft's Encarta encyclopedia and how Turkey was putting pressure, saying it would throw out Microsoft from Turkey if they talked about the Armenian genocide. What has come of that dispute?
I haven't followed the aftermath of the Encarta drama. At the time, the Microsoft people stood by the scholars who had prepared the entry on the Armenian genocide for the Encarta encyclopedia at the time. But what's so really tragic about this is that the Turkish government is disallowing its own people a proper intellectual education and democratic inquiry into its own history. I mean, one of the things that we affirm in a democracy is the importance of critiquing one's own culture and one's past, of doing it in the classroom, of doing it in the educational and popular culture of a given society. And Turkey has continually displayed its inability, its incapacity to engage in critical self-evaluation. And the Encarta episode is yet another tragic example of this.
Peter Balakian, we just have 10 seconds. What is happening in New York on Sunday?
On Sunday, there'll be a huge gathering at Times Square and then one following at St. Patrick's Cathedral to commemorate the 90th anniversary of the century's first genocide.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Peter Balakian, author of The Burning Tigress, also professor of English at Colgate University, and here in Los Angeles, Zanku Armenian of the Armenian National Committee of America. Thanks for being with us as we wrap up this week's Democracy Now! We continue our Unembed the Media tour today in Claremont, California at noon, the Humanities Auditorium, Scripps Campus, and then at 3:30, we will be at Glendale Community College, Crider Hall. Tonight, Berkeley, 8 o'clock, a benefit for Berkeley Community Media. Florence Schwimley Little Theater tomorrow in San Francisco, tomorrow night in Ashland, Oregon. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill. Ryan Abernathy, our engineer. DemocracyNow.org, our website. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.